I believe what we're experiencing when we have heartbreak is actually the crashing or destruction of expectations. And that's all. And that's helped me a lot to realize, A, to process through it much faster, and B, instead of looking at it as if somebody broke my heart or something broke my heart, of like, oh, what were the expectations that I had that just evaporated? Oh, I thought that nothing was going to change. And that's stupid because everything changes.
Welcome to Healthwise, the health and longevity podcast brought to you by Sunday Natural. I'm Niels Behrens, and in this podcast, we explore what it truly means to be healthy. Together, we will dive into topics such as medicine, exercise, nutrition, and emotional well-being, always with a wise perspective on what generally benefits us. This conversation was recorded live at the Colibri Spirit Festival, a gathering that celebrates connection, healing, and conscious transformation. In this episode, we dive deep into the theme of conscious longevity and explore how we can live longer, healthier, and more connected lives, starting from within. My guest today is Dr. Zach Bush, a triple board certified physician, thought leader in integrative health, and a passionate advocate for regenerative living. He's known for connecting the dots between the microbiome and environmental health and human consciousness, offering a radically holistic view of healing and longevity. At the Colibri Festival, he's inviting us on a journey to rebirth, a powerful exploration of what it truly means to live, to transform, and to thrive. And I say a warm welcome to Dr. Zach Bush.
So glad to be here with you, Niels. Thank you for having me.
Zach, how important are Sundays for our mental health?
There's an increasing appreciation, I believe, in society and in science around the importance of rest, the importance of moments of pause. And perhaps there's never been a more important time for that in human history than we stand in today as we start to ponder the science of our own extinction and look at the data of our accumulating stress and trauma at the genetic level that's being compounded with every generation now, pushing us towards this level of infertility and threat of extinction. What we are seeing over and over again is there's only one way to really start again, and that's to pause. We need to give rest to the genome. We have to give rest to the psyche that drives that genome into its trauma state. And so the concept of Sunday for me is, have you taken rest this week? Have you taken that moment to integrate the beauty that you've seen this week? Have you taken time to percuss and really live out and metabolize through the trauma and the pain that you've experienced this week so that you can begin again?
Okay, beautiful answer. So I'm really looking forward to this interview. Thank you very much. So your presentation of this, on the Colibri Spirit Festival will have the title Journey of Rebirth. What comes up for you personally when you hear this title? So what does rebirth mean to you on a human level?
Rebirth is a beginning that has to be a passage through death. And so a lot of what we'll be speaking with this week, I think, and pondering is, what is extincting? What is dying in the human experience right now? And what must die for us to continue? And if we look back through the last thousands of years, we can see that there's a pattern that unfolds over and over again in the human journey that revolves largely around war. And we have bombs dropping in the Middle East right now, and in Iran and Israel, Palestine, Syria, Yemen. We have places of war that have been at war for thousands of years. And that is played out in many different reverberations around the planet and through our different epochs and different histories of the rise and fall of empire. And largely, when you look at the root cause of war, you find a deep insecurity. Just like any bully on the playground, you know, the United States going over to drop bombs on, you know, a distant country in recent weeks. The bully-like behavior is something that is driven by deep insecurity. And if we look below the symptom of insecurity, we find almost invariably in science and in medicine an abandonment disorder. And I believe that this is really what we're playing out as humans today, is maybe a 5,000 to 7,000 year journey into a collective abandonment disorder in which we truly believe we were kicked out of nature.
Yeah. When I ask you personally, do you have a moment in your life that felt really like a true rebirth? So is there a point where everything shifted?
I would say I've been through so many deaths in the last 30 years that it's hard to keep track of them all. I've been through so many cycles of believing I've reached something, thinking I've found my truth or my path, only to find out that it was taking me into my next death cycle. And that, perhaps all of us are like this. We look back 3 to 5 years ago, let alone 15 years ago, and we laugh at remembering the hubris or the belief that we knew it was coming or the belief that we were in control of something, because our lives are such winding paths of hard left turns, high right turns, dead ends, redirects, and ultimately those moments of potent death and dying are frequent throughout a lifetime, I believe. And for me, my first really significant one, I think it happened when I was about 18, 19. That was around my first relationship, had a girlfriend, first time, broke my heart. And only as dramatic as an 18-year-old kid can be, I was like, I need to take a year off from college to integrate this new experience of all this pain and confusion and discomfort. And in some ways, my compass was just spinning at that point of how did I get myself into that situation? How did I not see that coming? How am I that blind to reality? And so I remember that feeling then. And at the moment I stopped and didn't, a tearful, deep inquiry out to the cosmos of what the hell just happened? The speed at which the answer was there in front of me was just kind of incredible. And it was beautiful to see myself through the wound. I got to see myself for a moment through the lens of somebody else, and that one gift of just being able to look in the mirror of the cosmos. And at that moment, I was laying on my back, staring up into the stars in Colorado, where I was born and raised. And Colorado is famous for being one of the higher altitude states in North America. And so you're in these incredible spaces with extremely dry air of Colorado. You get incredible starscapes. And so that Milky Way galaxy staring back down into you, if you're willing to let that see you, you will be reoriented very quickly. And I think this used to be the traditional methodology of humans. We slept under those stars every night, and we didn't sleep under dense roofs and layers of off-gassing drywall and insulation and metal roofs and everything else. We slept under the stars for hundreds of thousands of years. And so there was a nightly reorientation to who am I that we've lost track of. And so in our abandonment disorder from nature, we've continued to double down on that isolation from nature by our pursuit of comfort and by our pursuit of consumerism that comes out of the scarcity mentality of somebody who's been abandoned. And so that reorientation began at that point. I was blessed to be a Boy Scout in those years of my teens, and so I was camping every weekend in the high mountains, and so I got a lot of nature in my DNA in those first decades of my life. And then you would find my way into Western medicine, and it would take me off the path of nature again into a belief that there was a chemical solution for every disease and a chemical solution for every body. And that would be a 17-year journey in academia and in higher education, all my subspecialties and all my biomedical research and chemotherapy development. Everything I got involved with was taking me further and further from nature. But every time I looked through the microscope in my laboratory every day, I got to witness nature's beauty, and so as elusive and distant as it felt, I was seeing it every day. And I know that microscope is what brought me back to reality again. And 2010, when I left academia, it was because of this big disconnect between the science that I was being taught and practicing and the beauty that was unfolding under those microscopes. There was an increasing cognitive dissonance between those two worlds that I could no longer tolerate. And I was in major depression because of my disconnect from that. And it was the gentle, nudge of nature to push me back into her that became more like a sledgehammer by 2010. when I had a kind of a near-death experience there and a car accident situation. So these things culminated in some hard left turns and rebirth cycles. But I think, honestly, each of us can go through a litany of these rebirth moments in our lifetime. And if we tune in to that rebirth energy, I think we get to see it happen more and more frequently. It's a lot like starting to acknowledge that everything in the universe is a miracle. Einstein's, you know, perspective, either nothing's a miracle or everything's a miracle. You can't have it in between. And so if absolutely everything is a miracle in your life, including your current heartbreaks, your traumas, your insecurities, your scarcity, if everything is a miracle, in the same way, is everything welcoming you back into this abundant nature? Is everything, you know, pushing you back into the beauty? And the more you recognize the miracle, the more often the miracle will come, the more often you realize that you're rebirthing every moment, the faster you'll benefit from that rebirth and the quicker you'll transform.
What I really like on this sort is that at the end you are speaking about something very negative, but rebirth is a very positive term. So that means my personal believing is everything happens for a reason, and so this is more or less the same thing. So I'm very often had this thought that everything happened for a reason because something negative happens, and then I said at the end it turns out that this negative occasion or negative thing bring me to something more positive. So, and this is more or less when I understood you right, also this idea of a rebirth, is it correct?
Yeah, I think if you look at nature as a whole, you see an iterative process. You know, it's iterating all the time, and the only thing we can be absolutely sure of is nothing will be the same tomorrow.
That's true.
And if we really become comfortable with that, we'll stop doing what we call heartbreak. Heartbreak, actually, in my recent experience with this topic, I would say that heartbreak is probably one of the most misunderstood things in my life and perhaps in human existence. We keep attributing this sensation that we have when we go through heartbreak to our heart, as if we can break the thing. My current perspective, having come out of my heart space after 15 years of trying to build a world there, I've realized you can't break that heart thing. That heart thing is actually something that is not in the frequency of human emotions. It's a structure function within the space-time geometry of a human body that's imperturbable. You can't change it. That thing is a torrent of energy coming from source to everything that's been created. And you've been given 5 senses to see everything that's been created and to feel that and to touch that. And for that, this torrent of energy that we would call love, or, you know, authentic, unconditional love, is flowing out into the universe through a human being. You can't break that thing. That's indelible. It's permanent in its structure function because it's something about the fabric of the universe. I believe what we're experiencing when we have heartbreak is actually the crashing or destruction of expectations. And that's all. And that's helped me a lot to realize, A, to process through it much faster, and B, instead of looking at it as if somebody broke my heart or something broke my heart, of like, oh, what were the expectations that I had that just evaporated? Oh, I thought that nothing was going to change. And that's stupid because everything changes. And so, Zach, get the heck over your drama and retune in. Everything's changing all the time, and you're blessed to take another breath today as a human being. And so take that breath. Accept the miracles that are flowing in every day, and that's a rebirth process immediately.
I love it. So the idea of rebirth, how is it connected to the idea of conscious longevity?
Those are two words that I think were very, very in danger of poisoning. consciousness and longevity.
All right.
I was recently down in Costa Rica. I was doing an immersive experience for 120 people down there. And right in the few days before my event started, there was another group at the same facility that I was going to be running my retreat at that was running a investment group for psychedelics. Mm-hmm. And so they had come in from around the world to talk about, you know, their investment strategies on how they were going to make lots of money off of psychedelics, basically. And I got a text message that said, please join us this Thursday at 11:11 a.m. for a meeting, a special meeting of handpicked people that are going to discuss scaling human consciousness. The whole thing was so absurd to receive in a text message. The fact that somebody had the hubris to think that they were going to schedule a human meeting at some sort of angelic time of 11 a.m. to then scale consciousness is like, when you read that text and you really sit there with it, it's ludicrous on ludicrous on ludicrous on ludicrous. It's just like, consciousness is something that existed before time. Consciousness is the connection between the living three-dimensional material world and the knowledge field of everything. It is a portal between the finite and the infinite. It cannot be scaled. It cannot be descaled. It never went away. It never was missing. The fact that we have humans running around thinking that because they developed cryptocurrency and have done some psychedelics, they're now going to scale consciousness is our next death nail. That's our next death cycle, is believing that psychedelics or plant medicine are going to scale consciousness, are going to increase consciousness. Nothing increases consciousness. Human activity, consciousness is a permanent condition of connection between the finite and the infinite realities that are here. In the same way, longevity, we have all this biohacking movement going on globally. It's now a couple $100 billion industry, cranking out new product after new product. And, you know, the extent of the fallacy is probably witnessed recently. Yes, a bunch of friends of mine got together and created a biohacking center in Santa Monica, California, about two blocks off the beach of the Pacific Ocean. And you walk into this, like, you have to go into a giant glass steel building and then get in an elevator and go up to this floor. And now you're in this new off-gassing building full of carcinogens from paint and drywall and everything else. And then you go and there's like a cool logo and, you know, a front desk reception to longevity. And you walk through and they're telling you about this amazing room that's full of salt crystals all over the place. And you take off your shoes and you walk on the salt blocks and silica and the whole thing is beautifully engineered. And they're explaining, like, this is the equivalent of walking on the beach.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, we're two blocks from the beach. And then you go into another room, like, this is red light at this single wavelength frequency of red that increases metabolic, you know, mitochondrial activity. And this is far infrared over here, good for that. Near infrared, good for that. And so you're standing in front of these two blocks of red light naked. And I'm thinking, I'm missing sunset right now, which is every frequency of red light known to man, because I'm sitting inside of this building separate from nature. And so in the same ludicrous belief that we can increase consciousness through our you know, wealth gaining investments in psychedelics, the belief that we can create a room that's going to beat nature at her game of supporting human biology is a ludicrous proposition in the end. And so we've got to get over our masculine archetype, which is we got to fix everything. And we got to get into more of a feminine state, which is we're going to receive everything. If we don't, we will go extinct. We cannot technologically beat nature. AI is not going to do it. You know, AI is the gift that we have right now to look in the mirror and realize that we are each an assembly of 70 trillion quantum computers that are processing intelligence at a level that will probably never be met on this planet in any form of technology. We either have a biologic future or we have a technologic future. I believe the technologic future that we have, that we spend so much time thinking about, is taking us into a state of transhumanism where we'll have implants and computer chips in our brains and we'll have all this stuff to palliate our condition of separation from nature. And it will be a post-apocalyptic nightmare as far as I'm concerned. It's not a future I want to live into at all. And I do not want my grandson, who just started college, to be, you know, studying into a world of transhumanism. I don't want him to believe that he has to go find the technology to somehow make humans better. I would love for my grandson and my children and you know, the whole generations to come, to realize that the biology of humans have to go through a massive iterative rebirth, and that they should sit quietly in wonderment that the universe has already planned out that iterative process. And there's 10 to the 31 viruses in the air, and 10 to the 31 viruses in the soil, and another 10 to the 30 viruses in the ocean water, which are a genetic database of everything that is to come in on Mother Earth. The virome, the collection of viruses, are the future imagined but not yet lived into of this genetic thing that we call life on Earth. If we've got 10 to the 31 just in the air we're breathing, in my bloodstream right now, I have 10 to the 15, which is about 10 billion different viruses that my body is scanning. I have 10 billion viruses in my bloodstream right now that are being scanned by every cell in my body for gain of function. I trust that laboratory. I trust the laboratory of my body that's been given the opportunity to iterate a new humanity. And I am playing with the trees around me, with the species underground, the microbiome. I'm playing with the soil within me, the microbiome, the protozoa, everything else within me. I'm playing a genetic game right now of imagination. And if I'm going to do that well, and if I'm going to be part of the rebirth of a humanity, I'm going to have to listen rather than do. And so listening genetically, listening epigenetically, listening into the hormonal communication, listening into the redox communication networks around us and within us. The wireless network within us is rich with new information, and the human being and the human mind are central processing units for nature to speak through. And she's trying to show us a near future that is biologic. And it is perhaps, you know, a complete evolution of the human condition. Maybe we don't even look the same. Maybe we become brighter. Maybe we become shorter. Maybe we become taller. Maybe we become eight-legged. I have no idea what happens next, but it has to be different because we've pushed ourselves to the death cycle. And so as we go through this death together, if we hold on to each other in unconditional love and we let go of all the expectations that we're creating our heartbreak, we might just find ourselves in the freedom to change.
This is, I would say, everything you are explaining is for me pretty clear. Nevertheless, we have plenty of listeners which are now saying, okay, I also went to this kind of, let's say, longevity studios versus red light and versus, simulation of the beach and everything else. So the people are... they're looking for something. They're desperate in a way, and they want to have this journey of rebirth, and they want to have it now, and they don't want to wait. So is there a concrete advice you could give to them to start this journey?
Absolutely. It's so simple, and it's absolutely free, and it's available to every human on the planet right now, and that's to go lay down on your back underneath a tree. It is the most powerful rewiring of a brain. The quantum field that happens, the quantum connection that happens when you look through the chaotic pattern of branches and leaves against a blue sky, resets the neural network immediately. Whenever you look into a perfectly chaotic system, it can be a waterfall or it can be this, you know, branches of the tree against a sky. Whenever you see a system of complete chaos, you will witness sacred geometry in really big ways. So there's a whole field of physics called chaos theory that has worked all of this out. But if you dive into chaos theory, you find out that waterfall, every molecule of water falling will never be in the same pattern, even if that waterfall runs for 20 million years. The water is in a perfect chaotic state. And yet if you back up, they can witness these massive macro and even micro patterns of quantum physics geometry, quantum geometries and macro geometries that are following what we would call sacred geometry, stuff that's been imbued in our spiritual texts and practices and buildings and pyramids for tens of thousands of years. And so to begin the journey back into, you know, a reconnected state where consciousness is readily available in its full context and longevity as a result of your connection to biology around you, laying on the soil beneath a tree, looking at the sky, watching white clouds pass across that blue sky and past the chaos of the branching patterns and the leaves shimmering in the breeze. Go in there deep. It'll if you will be patient and you know, let the tree begin to see you, you can have the full LSD trip right there. You don't need any psychedelic plant medicine. You are the human medicine. The human medicine within you is the thing you're looking for. The plants can take you there for a moment to say, hey, look at this whole world you forgot about. But it's not going to take you into your full humanism. We need to leave plant medicine behind very soon and move into our human medicine if we're going to avoid extinction. To get into the human medicine, we have to be seen by nature. We can reorient ourselves. We can reorient the genetics within ourselves. We can reorient, most importantly, perhaps the water structure and the water memory within ourselves if we allow ourselves to be seen by nature. And so this is different than going out and wowing yourself with stars up in the sky. This is reversing the polarity. Let the stars see you. Let the tree see you. Let the clouds see you. And then when you make yourself vulnerable and available to be seen by nature, it's just like looking in a mirror and realizing, wow, my hair is totally messed up. I should probably do something about those curls. And I look into nature, I see beauty. I let nature see me. I immediately can feel and see and sense the cognitive dissonance, the areas that I covered up because they were uncomfortable to look at. And nature reorients you very quickly to it. And it reorients your value system. It reorients your sense of perception. It reorients your sense of metrics for success or failure. It starts reorienting you to a whole self. There's no way you're not whole. There's no way that you're missing anything else. You would not have been able to weave yourself together in the womb of your mother. 70 trillion cells from one is an impossible thing unless you were complete. And I believe if you've ever had the opportunity to see a child come into this world, a woman birthing a child in this planet is bringing a subject into nature that is whole. The child knows no incompleteness. And that's what gives you goosebumps when your three-year-old in the back seat of the car is looking out the window while you're driving along and you're distracted by your to-do list and frustrated about your banking situation. And then suddenly your three-year-old says, Mom, is it possible that we're actually inside of God? You know, like, it's like, wait a second, what? what did you just say back there? You know, it's like these children come in whole and they have full access to the conscious field. And it's not until about age 4 or 5 where we start to create these social constructs of preschool and education, which is a programming of these children into a state of belief that they're separate from nature and separate from one another, separate from the abundance of the divine itself. And so we program our children into scarcity. And then we tell them, now you have to go on a 50-year journey to go find yourself and to try to make yourself feel better by getting a good job and making lots of money and finding your person and getting married and having kids. And they're so lonely and distraught after all the check boxes have been checked and they feel just as, you know, disconnected and lonely. And then they have to go on their plant medicine journey and go sit with under the tree and they got to go find their way back to the fact that they were always whole. And it was the programming of our current human society that got them into a belief of scarcity. And so begin under the tree and then quickly move to a child's mind and a child's heart. And you'll find yourself into whatever longevity you choose to be here for. Not all of us chose to be here for long periods of time. Most of the souls that are touching through here are here for a very brief period of time. I've seen so many children disappearing at age 2, 3 years old from cancers that didn't used to exist. When I went to medical school, nobody had osteosarcoma at under the age of 80. Now we got three-year-olds dying of osteosarcoma all over the world. We have aged the human genome through the stored trauma that is the result of our disconnect from nature. If we plug back in, our children may choose to come longer. But every hospice bed that I've been at, hospice was my third subspecialty. For 4 years, I admitted 80 patients a week to die. When you see that much death, you start to realize there is no endpoint on this thing. And every exit strategy was on time, on purpose, whether it was a suicide or a cancer or whatever it is. These souls are picking their moment of exit just as they picked their moment of entry. And there is nothing we can do to change that date of next adventure. Some indigenous cultures believe that if you really go and sit with, you know, the trans-dimensional council that is your system of advice coming in, maybe you can re-sign a new contract to stay in the body after a death cycle. But they say it's extremely hard, you know, to do that. And it's very rare that somebody actually sits and decides to change their trajectory as a soul, because you already signed up for your next damn thing. And so we've got to stop thinking that longevity is the goal. I think that what's the goal for humanity now is coherence. If we reach a state of coherence, then some of us will live 1,000 years and some of us will live 2 years and some of us will abort in the womb because we didn't need the human journey on that soul trajectory. And so the fact that we think that the human life is some sort of penultimate experience of the soul is probably super inaccurate. It's one of the things that your soul will do is become human. And it is a blessed thing. And we should be so grateful for every moment we take a breath in this body. But I have a deep sense in my own life of I'm done here. I've seen, felt, touched, tasted everything a human can feel. So if the purpose is just to experience things, I'm done. If the universe keeps me here tomorrow and I breathe another day as being human, it's because it has a design of nature. Nature has a design with me still spelled as human. And I will be grateful for that. And I will try to touch more lives and I'll try to hug more people and I'll try to fall in love 5 more times tomorrow. Because it's our nature to be gifted the feeling and capacity to do all of that. But if I wake up tomorrow, worry about my Oura Ring data on my sleep hours and worried about the amount of information that my doc just told me about my fasting blood sugar, and I really want to live to 180 years like Dave Asprey, and I want to do, like, no, I don't think so. I don't. All of the centurions that I've taken care of as a doctor never once woke up worrying about living long. I was blessed with 2 great-grandparents that lived past 100 years. My grandfather on my dad's side, my grandmother on my grandfather on my mother's side, my grandmother on my dad's side, 102, 101. My great-grandfather was born in 1898. And I grew up skiing with him in the Rocky Mountains. So he skied until he was 96 years old. That guy was a crazy, some pre-version of a hippie. Before there was hippies, there was my grandfather. Had one of the first Volkswagen Bugs or buses, and drove all over the country with his skis on top, exploring the world. Always had some new adventurous friend with him. He was just a mile a minute and curious and passionate. Lived to 100 by accident. He was just jumping off ski things, all the time. My great-grandmother on the other side just had so much childlike joy. Spent the last 2 decades, I think, trying to find the best sex jokes she could possibly find. That was what kept her living long. She was just all the way to the end, making everybody laugh so hard. And she just was so curious. And she loved her martini at 5 o'clock. And she was the head of the welcoming reception for her community. She was just a mile a minute and never once worried about what health food she was eating, never worried about what smoothie she needed or protein shake, never ever did any of that. But she stayed childlike in her mind and in her heart. And so I think we've got to let go of the clinging to life so that we can live. Clinging to life is a fast way to be dead before your body's gone. You can't live when you're clinging to something. When you're holding on to life, it won't flow. And if you don't feel life flowing within you, you're going to feel a desperate nature within you that's trying to reconnect to your psyche. And so let go of the longevity story. Let go of the story of scaling consciousness for yourself. You don't need to go find your consciousness. You are a conscious being. You've been a spiritual entity since the beginning of time. You're a fractal of God. You don't have to go find your consciousness. And you don't have a life purpose. You don't have to go find your path. There's no person out there you need to go find. There's nobody no guy out there that's going to make you feel whole. There's no woman out there that's going to make you feel safe. There's you. And you came in alone and you're going to exit alone. But that is not lonely. You came in whole, connected, and in wonderment that you were about to go on a journey into the finite realm of believing you were separate from everything so that you could see the beauty. When you're connected to everything, you can't sense it. It's like the fish in the ocean. The fish has no idea there's an ocean. It's simply a fish, and it's swimming in the cosmos. And so the fact that we come into human is so that we can be separate from the cosmos for a minute, so that we can see the beauty of the ocean. The separateness of the human condition has got its own indelible gift in it, and it's got its own vulnerability of believing you're separate, therefore rejected. You're separate in your perception so that you can see the beauty. You're not separate because you were rejected.
Wow, that's a lot to digest. You have mentioned one thing. It was about a little bit about loneliness, because you're speaking also sometimes about healing through communities. And we are now at the moment at the Colibri Spirit Festival. What do you think, what these kind of, let's say, gatherings are they relevant on a journey to rebirth?
They must be, because we're doing it. Humans are doing it. And so whatever the heck we're doing is relevant. The wars we're fighting right now are relevant to our journey. The performative nature that we can find ourselves in a festival is part of what we're doing. If we need to perform consciousness for a period of time until we come silent and just receive consciousness, that's fine too. I was a doctor to an ashram for a while by accident. I set up my first rural clinic in Virginia with the intention of trying to find a pathway for fifth generation poverty to come into, you know, a space of self-empowered health. And so I thought we could do that through nutrition. So I went into this environment of deep poverty and accidentally, or by the universe's great purpose, my clinic was just a few miles from one of the largest ashrams on the East Coast in the United States. And so this ashram had, you know, been running for 4 decades, and the guru, Satchidananda, who had passed away some time ago, had left quite a lineage and had built quite a beautiful facility of kind of, you know, unity consciousness. And, you know, the Lotus Temple there has a nod to every religion on the planet, and recognizing that they converge at the two words of love and light. And it has scriptures from every single religion on the planet showing the central nature of those two concepts, love and light. Beautiful place. One of the most dysfunctional communities that you can possibly imagine.
And okay.
Those that I was taking care of were riddled with some of the worst anxiety I've ever seen. And so, opposite of what you would think, with yogis that had been living on an ashram for, you know, 5 to 25 years, you would think that they would have found themselves in a state of peace, a state of acceptance, self-acceptance at the very least. Instead, what you find is this radical state of discomfort, extreme anxiety, to the point of they can't leave their house. They can't meditate. They can't do yoga because they're so anxious. They have agoraphobia. They're terrified of seeing other humans. They've become, you know, paranoid. I've now traveled the world to find out that every community that calls itself a spiritual community is prone to creating the same conditions. And so anytime we think we are going to scale consciousness or create a spiritual community, we tend to breed an enormous amount of codependence and enormous amount of insecurity unintentionally. The healthiest communities in the world that I have seen do not call themselves spiritual communities. They actually call themselves, you know, a community or a city or a town or a village. And they know each other. And I think it's that knowing your neighbor part and seeing the value of your neighbor's skill set and the beauty they carry and the uniqueness of your neighbor. And these communities we now call blue zones, and because they have a tendency to all live past 100 years of age. And so blue zones are inherently the healthiest communities in the world. And there's not one of them that set out to be a spiritual community. Mm-hmm. There's not one of them that set out to scale consciousness. They are there because they understand the beauty of multi-generational living, and they have curiosity for the person they haven't met yet. And so they always set a chair at the table at night, hoping that somebody that they don't know will come by and share a meal. These are the traits of the human cultures and villages and communities that have really found, I think, the vibrant state of being alive. There are small villages in Italy. There are small villages, you know, in Sardinia. There are small villages in the middle of China. And there are villages that are inherently connected around food. And doesn't mean the food's even good. And it's from a nourishment standpoint, but it's rich in culture. This is the food that's been prepared for generations and generations. And it may be full of chemicals and it may be full of all kinds of junk, but they continue to live long despite the junk because they continue to transmute those poisons through the fellowship of being human. When humans come together, we can transmute everything. any poison within your food can be transmuted through the grace that you will say over that food. Saying a blessing on the food before it's consumed is your most powerful tool to reconnecting to the nourishment of nature. And so take a moment, breathe, smell the food together. Recognize that you chose to come in fellowship around food again tonight at the dinner table. Focus in for a moment. Drop the to-do list, drop the success failures of the day. Recognize that you're about to do something spectacular, which you're going to open up your body to be a conduit of ascension for the nutrients of the earth through the food you're about to eat is going to ascend through your body into higher and higher states of consciousness because you're human. And so you don't have to scale consciousness. You are consciousness. You are a connection between three-dimensional finite and the infinite. So the carrot that is on your plate is about to go back into the infinite state of reconnection to everything through the bloodstream of a human being that will course through your mind, that will course through your heart, that will course through the silence of the womb within you. We have to start to give ourselves the space to receive the nourishment for this rebirth to really take hold.
You said two things. So you mentioned about your grandma that she has a kind of, said it was a kind of childish mind. And you also said that in the blue zones, the people are curious to get connected with other people. So when I do my presentation about a healthy long life, I'm always saying that maybe from my point of view, one of the most important secret source is curiosity. Would you agree to that, or is it just a coincidence that you mentioned it twice?
No coincidence at all. I think you're right on the path right there. Brings to mind a statement from Khalil Gibran about 100 years ago when Khalil Gibran was asked, how should you parent? He said, it's very simple to parent. All you have to do is every day strive to think more like your child and make sure you never teach your child to think like you. And I think that's really getting at the essence of how do we become whole humans again. That child had to be taught by adults that they're not whole and that they're incomplete and they have to go pursue all of this stuff externally to themselves to be valuable to the family, to the community, etc. And so the child came in knowing it was whole, knowing it was, sitting between a finite world that wanted to make its way back to the infinite divine through a human body, through a human witnessing of the beauty and the taste and the feel of the food, the nourishment of the nature around it. And so if we stop programming our children with incompleteness and we move ourselves back into curiosity and try to think more like the child every day, I think we solve for the human condition. And we let our inhumanity go extinct and we step into a new future of biologic humanity.
What I really like, there's one thing, and Huberman is very bullish about a specific kind of breathing, this side breathing. And it is this double inhaling and then the long exhaling. And what you can observe, especially on small children, is that when they are really upset, that when they are crying, they're doing exactly that. And it is so interesting that we know how to bring our nervous system and we lost this knowledge on our way. This is for me just a very good example how a 5-year-old child now know better to bring down the nervous system better than we are doing it.
Absolutely. And it wasn't a forgetting, it was a reprogramming. As soon as that child starts throwing that experience, that massive expose of feeling, everybody rushes around trying to tell the child to stop doing it. Stop crying, stop making that fit. You're being ridiculous.
We even say in Germany, don't be so curious.
Wow, really?
Really, it is curiosity is something which is not a good habit.
Wow.
Don't be so curious. This is something really, Max, you don't know it from your childhood?
Yeah.
Sorry, we just have a listener and I just want to...
Curious and I know it.
Wow.
I say it in Germany.
That's a German phrase. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I come from Pennsylvania Dutch, which is kind of this lineage of German through the United States. And that actually, as I think back through that part of my family, that plays very true. My grandmother, Pennsylvania Dutch, had the same carpet from 1963 until she moved out of her house 40 years later. Like, there was a lack of curiosity expressed in her and what the society was allowing her to live, for sure. That's interesting. I didn't realize that. That's a really interesting statement.
So I think we can't make an interview with you without speaking about poisons in our food. So you mentioned it already that we can handle it, or we are used to handle it when we are in our traditional environment, traditional food. Nevertheless, we see in nowadays that people are changing to one superfood to the next one, and everyone is now saying, okay, gotchi beers will save our life, and at the end they are from China and they're completely poisoned. So do we have a recommendation for our listeners how to, let's say, identify what they should eat and what they should avoid a little bit better?
If you can see the tomato growing on the vine, you're right on your solution. If you can see the zucchini hanging from the plant before you pick it for dinner, you're right on target. You got to get super close to your food system to avoid the toxins. And my laboratory has been studying the effect of herbicides on human biology for the last 15 years. And we've shown that science over and over again to the Environmental Protection Agency, to the USDA. I've shown it to senators. I've shown it to universities. And the needle has not moved at all. I recently showed it to the leadership of Saudi Arabia, and it moved the needle. What it speaks to is the West has developed a culture in which we do not care. We have forgotten the value of future generations, and we have not built a society that cares for those future generations. We have not built a society that values the nature that will be around those generations or within those generations. Saudi gave me a big look at a culture that has not left their value system of generations to come. They are thinking seven generations ahead in every decision they make. That is really interesting. And it's something that I think should humble the West, which is, when did we forget to value the future? When did we forget to metric the value or impact of a product or decision or behavior on seven generations from now? And so I'm eager to work with every culture around the world that hasn't forgotten that we are living and our behaviors are translating to seven generations ahead, if not, you know, obviously far further. And so that's something that we need to really redirect to. And in food systems, there's nothing more valuable than growing your own food or participating in that food system. And the end of World War II, all of the countries that were considered allied forces were growing victory gardens. And at that point, the United States and beyond were growing more than 40% of their food system in their backyards. Today, we grow 0.001% of our food in our backyards. And so we're down to, you know, one 10,000th of our food coming from our backyards. It's a pathetic number. And there's no wonder we don't know what healthy food looks like. And it's no wonder we get duped into believing that some new superfood has come along to save us. I'll leave you with this, I guess, when it comes to food. And this whole is similar to the biohacking movement, where it's a marketing machine and it is a multi-billion dollar, really trillion dollar. It's in the U.S. alone, it's around, you know, $1.8 trillion a year. It's a massive multi-trillion dollar marketing agency that's trying to convince you that somebody else has got the food you need, or something, somebody else has cracked the code on your nutrition for your longevity and the rest. But I would take you back to the words of Wendell Berry. Wendell Berry was one of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century coming out of the U.S., and he testified in front of Congress over and over again as early as the 60s, I think, but it, you know, it was heavy through the 1970s. He was showing Congress a future that would unfold if they didn't correct the herbicide pesticide usage within our food systems, if we didn't correct our land management practices that was destroying biodiversity. Nobody else in the world seemed to be paying attention to this at the time, but Wendell Berry was so patiently there, and he was a poet like no other. And so there's, if you Google Wendell Berry Senate hearings, you'll see some video clips still available online. He would deliver his testimonies in front of Congress in poetic form, and it was just so potent. But a distillation of one of my favorite, you know, monologues that he gave to the Senate was, until we recognize every space and place as sacred, we will only create desecrated spaces. Until you recognize everything as sacred, you will only know desecrated things. Until you recognize every piece of food as sacred, you will only eat desecrated food. For as long as you keep thinking that some things are superfoods and some things are not from nature, you know, all things from nature are sacred. All things from are superfoods. Your spinach, your kale that gets all disparaged by your current, you know, keto guys and everything else, that stuff is sacred. Currently, we're farming it in ways in which it's being disconnected, and we've disconnected our kitchens from the use of these things to make their nutrients available to the human body, and so then we think they're toxic. We're simply not preparing our food correctly. We need more space and time for the food to become whole and available to ourselves. The goji berry or the acai bowl or whatever, you know, superfood next for you is not a superfood. It's a nutrient-dense element of nature that probably has as many inflammatory compounds as it does medicines within it. And unless it's prepared through its traditional techniques, you're going to hurt yourself with that thing too. It's going to cause increase of inflammation. And certainly a supply chain that suddenly decides that there's a superfood immediately becomes more toxic because you're asking some indigenous culture to scale a food system to 8 billion people that suddenly want it in their smoothie. It's going to become dysfunctional, and you're going to extract and destroy the nature that thing is coming from. And so every time we look outside of ourselves or look outside of our own biosphere for some solution, we create what the Course of Miracles refers to as a sacred or a special relationship. Special relationship is the condition in which you will look outside of yourself for something that you think you cannot get from source. You will cling to that or connect to that until you've drained it out of the system or the person, and then you will leave. That's a good description of our food system. We will scour the world for the next source of food and then we will connect to that, and we will suck it dry until it's dead, and then we'll leave. And that culture and those people will die hungry for the West having sucked the nutrients out of their soils for the effort toward. Our soil under our feet is the sacred space we need to start to get reacquainted with. We need a disseminated, you know, decentralized food system desperately in this world again. That's what Victory Gardens was a decentralized food system. Farmers used to have everything on their farm. They had pigs, they had cattle, they had chickens, they had 7 to 15 different cash crops, they had fruit trees, they had the whole thing. Today, a farmer has one crop, corn or soybean for the season. They have one harvest, and that harvest is vulnerable to increasing instability because of the disconnect of the soil from nature. The abusive nature of a monoculture farm makes that crop more and more vulnerable, so therefore the farmer is more and more likely to hit bankruptcy. Today, 50% of the farms in the United States are one crop away from bankruptcy, 50%. The average age of farmers throughout the United States varies between 55 and 75, depending on which state you're in. We are aging out our farmers. We have sucked dry our farmland from the nutrients and carbon life force within it. And for that, we are losing our life force as humans, and we spawned the chronic disease epidemic for the failure of energy within our soil and food systems and now our bodies. And so it's the failure of energy metabolism at the fundamental level that's got our two-year-olds having this, you know, condition that we would call, you know, chronic disease or osteosarcoma and dying young. We've got to amp things back up. We got to return to a higher vibration state of our frequencies of food. And for that, we're going to have to understand the sacredness and specialness of every single spot we live. Your home, your backyard, tear up the lawn, start doing agroforestry in your backyard, get fruit trees, get perennial food forests going, bushes, vines, trees that are producing perennially, no farming needed. The tree is going to create abundance in your household. Get you know, 10 to 15 species of annual crops put in there next to your perennial food forest. Create abundance in there. It does not take as much energy as you think it is. It takes a little bit of learning. Farmers Footprint is one of our services with Project Biome, my nonprofit. Farmers Footprint has a whole backyard gardening tutorial. You can go through it within, you know, a single weekend of taking that coursework. You can begin the journey back into a nutrient-dense, reconnected food system for your family and for your community. In moments, it takes so little effort ultimately, and it's an incredible reconnect, an incredible, you know, reaccessing the consciousness that needs no scaling.
From my experience, it sometimes really helps to let the people understand why it is so negative to, for example, eat something which is full of glyphosate. So,
is it glyphosate?
Yes. Yeah. So so for example, you always knew that alcohol is not healthy, but when you really say, okay, drinking a bottle of wine, it is for a man like smoking 5 cigarettes, for a woman like smoking 10 cigarettes, then the people understand a little bit better how bad it is in the course of causing cancer. So when we now are talking about the effect of glyphosate on, let's say, on our microbiome, what is the effect? How can we compare it in a way?
There's something like 120 different carcinogens and endocrine disruptors in the daily life of a woman putting on cosmetics, and there's about 60 in a glass of wine now. And so from our cosmetics to our wine to everything else that we consume, we changed the playing field of these things in our lives. Wine did not used to cause cancer. Wine was a medicinal for tens of thousands of years. It was one of the most important ways to provide hydration in indigenous cultures is to ferment their beverages. And so if you go into the Amazon today and you sit with the Kutanawa or the, you know, Achwa or any of the tribes deep in the Amazon, all they drink is these fermented beverages that are high in alcohol so that they can be drunk without amoeba and dysentery and all this stuff. They can't drink fresh water in the Amazon because it's all full of microbiome that's going to create dysbiosis or imbalance in their own bodies. And so they only drink alcohol, essentially. And so, okay. You know, and so the fermented beverages of the past were medicinal, and they had great purpose within the food system. Fermented foods were a critical daily part of our lives. Today, we have changed the way in which these things are done, and so now they create carcinogen, not because wine or fermented grapes causes cancer, it's because of all the chemicals and additives and stabilizers and fake, you know, taste that's put into these things through natural flavorings, quote unquote. All of that's what's causing cancer. And so if you drink a clean wine, a family-grown wine in Greece, you're going to have a completely different experience. You're going to have no headache in the morning. You're going to have no inflammation in the body 2 days later. It's the process is not the problem. It's the additives and everything in there. Fermenting grapes into wine is not the problem. But unfortunately, I've had to wean myself off of wine altogether. It's one of my favorite things to experience. A good bottle of wine with a group of people is one of the most exquisite things a human will experience. And yet I hardly do it anymore because to find that clean bottle of wine is such a pain in the ass. And it's just not worth the hangover of the immune system and everything else after a single glass of wine anymore. And so it's really the process of disconnecting our food system from nature through chemical processing, chemical farming, chemical production of our highly processed beverages and foods that leads to this toxicity. You mentioned glyphosate, and it's worth kind of focusing in on it for a moment because it's our number one toxin worldwide. It's a water-soluble toxin. It's in a family of molecules called organophosphates. It's a potent salt, therefore water soluble. This is a problem because anywhere water is, this chemical will go. We have a planet that's 70% water by surface area. We have a soil system that relies on bacteria and microbiome that's 70% water in the cellular system of the microbiome. It grows plants that are 70% water. It grows humans that are 70% water. And so there's so much water in what we call life on this planet that when we start adding water-soluble chemicals to the equation, it becomes imbued or inherent in everything. And this is where we're at with glyphosate. We have sprayed more glyphosate every year since its debut in 1974. Currently, we're spraying about 4 billion pounds or 2 billion kilograms of this chemical globally every year, 2 billion kilograms. it's such an astonishing, massive number. Like, imagine a kilogram of anything, and now imagine 2,000 million kilograms. Like, it's just such an astonishing number of a powdered chemical that ends up, you know, being dissolved into water in the form of herbicides that are being sprayed onto your food and soils globally. It functions as a potent antibiotic, wiping out the microbiome of soil, wiping out the microbiome of your gut. That's the beginning of the problem. Our laboratory has demonstrated again and again that there's dozens of other deep cellular structure function phenomena that happen with glyphosate in the current amounts that you're seeing in your air, rain, food, etc. This chemical is breaking down many, many different protein structures, enzyme pathways, cell signaling pathways, and the rest. And so glyphosate is, I think, public enemy number one in regards to chemical poisoning of our future and our current biology. One of the first things that happens when glyphosate touches a cell membrane is it destroys the tight junctions, which means this Velcro between the cells that will create a coherent barrier falls apart. And so the first barrier that fails is the gut lining itself. And so this creates leaky gut. Our laboratory has been able to grow blood-brain barrier and gut in the same petri dish in two different layers and introduce glyphosate to the gut layer, blows it apart, and instantly peptides from the gut injury go up and break apart the blood-brain barrier. And so within seconds of leaky gut, you have leaky brain. And this is why the five top symptoms of gluten sensitivity, which is basically just glyphosate poisoning. Gluten's not the problem. It's the glyphosate that's carried in the gluten. We've been eating wheat since the beginning of time, really. It was when we started spraying the wheat in 1991 with glyphosate that suddenly in the 1990s, we all developed gluten sensitivity, celiac disease, which is the autoimmune condition to wheat and all this. And so glyphosate poisoning leads to leaky gut to leaky brain. When you read the symptoms of gluten sensitivity, you will see that it's not gut first. It's brain fog, headaches, lack of concentration, poor sleep quality, and then finally gut bloating. And so it's like the bottom problem is the gut. The things you're going to experience on the top are all of the central nervous system issues from that leaky brain. So leaky gut, leaky brain. We've also demonstrated that it then leads immediately to leaky liver, which means your liver is not packaging and sending out materials, bionutrients, bioavailable nutrients in the same way, and then leaky kidney. The kidneys are just giant bundles of blood vessels, and they're the most specialized blood vessels in the whole body. The kidney tubule is an incredible filtration system with multiple, at least six different specialized cells that will produce a single kidney tubule to do all of the filtration and reabsorption of the nutrients your body requires. And so from the liver to the kidney to the gut to the brain, all of these barriers are breaking down under glyphosate poisoning. And so if you were going to eliminate one chemical globally, I would vote for glyphosate instantly. It is basically the gatekeeper of all the other chemicals. And unfortunately, it's the tip of the spear that's piercing the human condition right now. Behind it is things like 2,4-D, which is a very, very close cousin to this. 2,4-D is another organophosphate. It's the same chemical as Agent Orange that was used for 25 years in Vietnam to destroy the jungles of Cambodia and North Vietnam. And so that chemical, Agent Orange, was flipped into its mirror image to create a molecule that we now refer to as 2,4-D because it was going to be really difficult to. We already knew that Agent Orange was causing massive cancer in our vets and everything else and lots of other problems with the immune system. And so it was going to be hard to market Agent Orange as a food additive. Now today we call it 2,4-D, and it's used all over the Midwest of the United States, growing farms all over Europe, all over the place. So 2,4-D is a disaster. Atrazine is a very old carcinogenic herbicide that glyphosate was supposed to replace. We're now spraying more atrazine than glyphosate in the United States because so many of our weeds in our farm fields got genetically modified to be Roundup resistant. And so the way that nature works is it's a very sharing economy when it comes to genetic information. And so when you genetically modify a crop, corn, soybean, roses, whatever it is, you genetically modify the crop and you start spraying the crop and the microbiome with that chemical that you've genetically modified it to survive. So you're spraying glyphosate Roundup everywhere. The pressure on the microbiome, the pressure on other weed species is you know, one of extinction level stress. In that extinction level stress, the biology starts to share gain of function opportunities to save the biodiversity. And so the corn will actually pass its genetic modification over to the microbiome and over to the weeds to help protect the nature that it needs to grow. The corn can't grow alone. Corn has to be connected to soil, has to be connected to the microbiome. So the corn is going to go do its best to take care of an environment that's being poisoned. And so it's going to share those. And so it shared those genes all over the place. And so now we have all these weeds that aren't killed by glyphosate because they got the genetic modification from the corn. And so now we have all these Roundup resistant weeds. So we're back to spraying atrazine, which is, you know, known toxin. You know, that's why Congress approved glyphosate back in the day and everything else to their regulatory agencies, because they were so excited that maybe there was something safer than atrazine. Well, now we're spraying more atrazine than ever before because of all the Roundup resistant weeds that we've created. And so this is the same thing we're doing in ICUs as well. You keep spraying antibiotics in human veins and into human lungs and everything else in the ICU, you create antibiotic resistant microbiome. And so this, and then we consider that the problem rather than realizing it's our antibiotic behavior that's creating the problem. So overall, I would say glyphosate is, you know, a symptom of the overall human condition of our belief that nature is against us. We repurposed, you know, Agent Orange from a chemical warfare to food additive. So we're on a war with food. We're on a war against hunger. We're on a war against cancer. We're on a war against obesity. We're in war against diabetes. We have this warlike mentality, whereas if we would just freaking stop poisoning the earth and stop the war for a moment, the rate of healing would be unprecedented and we can move back to it. And that's my goal for humanity is, it's time for us to share a new vision for our human condition where we will stop the war. What if we agreed across the 196 countries or 200 plus that we now have? What if we agreed that for one generation we will have no war? And if we decide that that isn't working, we'll go back to doing war again in 25 years. But for 25 years, let's do no war. Let's park the planes, let's park the bombs, let's park the chemical warfare, let's park the chemical additives to our food. Let's just try it for 25 years. Let's build a new economy around biologic wellness. Let's build a new economy around biosphere economics. And you know, let's start to build regional and bioregional economies that are built on distributed energy, environmental, ecologic, you know, technologic systems. That's something that I'm ready to help lead the charge on. Like, let's do this. And my companies over the last 15 years have been innovating different spaces within that health, energy, ecology space to start to see how this could be done. And in that is a new economy, a new way of currencies, the way in currencies can be backed by real world assets. Real world assets start to be metriced by their carbon metabolism. So pretty soon the entire global economy is being backed by nature and is fueling nature through its inherent relationship back to the biodiversity within it. So there's simple ways that we can start to really, we have all the technology we need to communicate around these new monetary systems, around new systems of collaboration between technology, industry, and nature. These things are sitting right in front of us, and I believe that there's an opportunity for us to agree. One generation, no war.
I love the idea, and I hope that we will find a way to agree on that. Unfortunately, our time comes to an end because you have to leave to the next appointment. So due to this, I come to my final question. If you could offer one sentence to send someone off on their own journey of rebirth, what would it be?
There's nothing I've said that's going to help you, really. I think that the tree is where you're going to begin the journey. I really recommend you all find that tree and then make a pilgrimage to that tree daily or as often as you can until you start to sense into the energy between my words today. I don't have any wisdom for you. I can't scale your consciousness. I can't scale my own consciousness. But I can sit long enough to find my consciousness and to tap into this thing that needs no scaling. And so tap into nature, find that tree, find the sky behind it, and then allow that tree and sky to see the beauty in you. And I think you'll start on a big journey into your rebirth.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Niels.
Another question. Do you have a favorite supplement?
I would say my favorite future is a world without supplements. And so to get there, my favorite resource for nutrients for the body are whole food, whole soil sources. And so rather than taking a single nutrient from nature, something like, you know, your vitamin D or magnesium or manganese or selenium or silica, all these things that are critical to human biology, instead of trying to micromanage that through, you know, mega dosing of any single micronutrient, we need to start to understand how nature delivered those. And so for my own company, for our soil extract company, we stopped trying to geoengineer the human microbiome with probiotics and prebiotics and all this stuff, and started to realize that we need to utilize the communication network and the delivery system of the microbiome as a resource for humans. And so while it's sold as a dietary supplement, it's actually not a supplement at all. It's really a delivery system for the nutrients within your food. And so when you take ION, which is an acronym for Intelligence of Nature, when you take that liquid supplement next to your food, you're increasing the bioavailability of all of the micronutrients within your food by 3,000-fold. And so it's, you know, it's logarithmically more effective than something like liposomal preparations and all these things of extracted chemicals, because it's the whole plant. The ION is a whole extract from the microbiome of 60 million years ago, before the last great extinction, before the last destruction of topsoils. And so it's an ancient, you know, full representation of nature's intention for fueling plants and peoples back into their full nutrient, you know, resource. So from my standpoint, we will do best when we find every piece of food as sacred, and we start to reconnect our gut and our food system to the microbiome through these systems of whole food, whole nutrients, whole soil systems.
If you enjoyed this episode, I'd be thrilled if you could leave a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. To make sure you never miss out, subscribe to our newsletter. It's not just about this podcast. We regularly introduce new products, often with special introductory discounts. You wouldn't want to miss out on that, wouldn't you? Subscribe to our newsletter at www.sunday.de/newsletter.